and sustainable and durable peace agreement for Ukraine, one that protects Ukraine's democracy, one that protects Ukraine's sovereignty. We should all support that. But without the participation of Ukraine, I'm very, very skeptical that we're going to get anything like that.
And Jeff Sachs, what about that? It is the Ukrainians who are actually fighting against Russia, and yet the Trump administration seems to feel that it can negotiate without Ukrainians present. And in addition to that, I wanted to ask you another issue. There's been a lot of emphasis on these rare earth minerals that Trump raised, but there has been, according to many reports, massive buying of Ukrainian land by American agribusiness companies. Can you tell us anything about that, the validity of these claims?
Sure. The American role in this has been quite sordid for a very, very long time. The goal, starting back in 1994, was to expand NATO and surround Russia in the Black Sea region. President Clinton signed off on that in 1994. Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote about it in the Grand Chessboard in 1997, explaining it, and explaining in a chapter that is completely wrong when you look back at it, said Russia will not be able to resist any of this. In 2002, the U.S. destabilized the relationship by unilaterally abandoning the anti-ballistic missile treaty. In 2008, the United States invited Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO, basically over strong objections by the Europeans, but the Europeans went along in the NATO Bucharest summit in 2008, over Russia's brightest red lines. This was all known, understood provocations. All of the diplomats knew it. European leaders knew it. I spoke with them at the time. Everybody understood this. In February 2014, the United States participated actively in a violent coup to overthrow Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, who favored neutrality. This is very important to understand. The coup took place on February 22nd, 2014. Again, I saw some of this with my own eyes. It was ugly. The U.S. involvement in this coup. U.S. forces paid for this coup to an important extent. They stirred up this coup. This is all well understood. Now, in 2015, the war could have ended with the Minsk II agreements, but the United States and Ukraine, despite the U.N. Security Council backing, said, no, you don't have to do that. That was not a territorial claim on the Donbas by Russia. It was a claim for autonomy that the UN Security Council unanimously supported, and the U.S. and the governments in Ukraine, at the U.S. behest to an important extent, completely dissed. And then it's true that Biden and Putin met in 2021, but in December 2021, President Putin put on the table a draft U.S.-Russia security agreement. It was a completely negotiable document. I spent quite a bit of time speaking with the White House about that document. There should have been negotiations. The U.S. rejected negotiation over the central point, which was non-NATO enlargement to Ukraine. Biden knew what he was doing. It was a terrible mistake of the Democrats, let me say, and of President Biden and his team. Then in March 2022, just days after the start of Russia's invasion, but by the way, the war had been going on for years, but this escalation in starting February 22nd, 2022, just days after that, they went to the negotiating table. And they came very close to an agreement until the U.S. and Britain stopped it. Bojo, Boris Johnson, one of the most irresponsible politicians in our modern time, explained it explicitly later. He said this is a war about preserving Western hegemony. Yes, this was a proxy war against Russia. This was the plan all along. And the U.S. and U.K. talked or told Zelensky, basically, leave. Now, again, As I said earlier, I went to Ankara to discuss this in detail with the diplomats. I know the details of what happened. Ukraine left the negotiations that could have ended this in March 2022 with few deaths. And instead, there have been nearly a million deaths since then. This has been, unfortunately, a game of the United States for 30 years that Zbigniew Brzezinski spelled out in 1997. The U.S. thought they had the upper hand at every time. It was the economic sanctions or the weapons that were going to bring Russia to its knees. It was incredibly naive. I said so for many, many years.
Professor Sachs.
I said Ukraine will become the Afghanistan of Europe, and so it has. Now, today in Saudi Arabia, maybe Ukraine can be saved from what the U.S. deep state set along the path of the last 25 years.
Professor
and this is
Sachs,
the biggest hope of today.
Professor Sachs, Matt Duss said he agreed with a lot of what you said. And I was wondering if you agree with him in condemning Russia's invasion in 2022.
Of course I condemn Russia's invasion. And of course I condemn the reasons for the provocation. I condemn the destabilization of the nuclear framework, which was the most important element of all in this. The United States walked out of the ABM Treaty and the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty unilaterally and would not negotiate with the Russians over this. The United States overthrew a government in Ukraine. The United States refused to negotiate with the Russians over basic security issues. This is a tragedy. But the core of the tragedy is U.S. unipolarity assumed by the neocons as early as 1992, put in place by Clinton starting in 1994. And it's been a consistent U.S. policy up until today, basically. And Trump is actually, amazingly, it seems, trying to change it, which is unbelievable for us. I voted for Biden, of course. I was also an advisor to Bernie Sanders. I just want to be clear. This is a shock to me that it's coming from this side of the American politics. The Dems became warmongers.
Matt,
period.
That certainly also reverberates with your title about the Democrats becoming the party of war. The latest news out of Riyadh, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says officials at U.S.-Russia talks agreed to restore embassy staffing, create a high-level team to negotiate peace in Ukraine, peace and promote economic cooperation. Your thoughts on this and where this history goes from there?
Yeah, I mean, I read that readout. I think it's interesting. I would also note that in that one of those points is not just economic cooperation, but, quote, investment opportunities. So, again, it really does seem like the Trump administration is not just trying to make peace, but trying to, you know, talk about potentially dividing the spoils with Russia. And that is very concerning because I don't think that's going to lead to a sustainable and durable peace agreement. But again, in basic terms, it's good and fine that the United States and Russia are talking. We need to talk to our adversaries. More generally, I think that's always true, but the details will matter. And again, Ukraine's buy-in is absolutely necessary for this. This is not an agreement that can be made over their heads. And I do want to step back and just respond to a couple of things that Professor Sachs said in the kind of history that he laid out. It is very interesting to me that the Ukrainians themselves play little, if any, role in the history that Professor Sachs just lays out. This idea that 2014 was just a U.S.-backed coup is false. Yanukovych was overthrown after one of the largest demonstrations in Ukraine's history, known as the Euromaidan. It was not the case that Yanukovych simply wanted to make Ukraine neutral. He wanted to draw Ukraine closer to Russia in a way that an overwhelming majority of Ukraine Ukrainians reject it. So we need to understand the history in all its complexity here. The Ukrainian people played a major role in that event. They played a major role in the decision to resist quite admirably and courageously the Russian invasion of their own country. Now, going back to the negotiations in March of 2022, I think to treat the talks that took place in Turkey as if they would have simply ended the war, again, is not accurate. Now, there were interesting possibilities in those talks. There's little evidence that Putin himself was completely bought in. I'm very skeptical that having launched a major invasion a month before, he would have been willing simply to end that invasion. But again, this story that Professor Sachs is telling of the United States as the major manipulator and the key problem, and everyone else is simply reacting to what the United States does, I think does not really reckon with reality. I'm certainly a critic of U.S. foreign policy. I'm a strong critic of the Biden administration's foreign policy. But I do think if we want to have a real and honest discussion about where U.S. foreign policy has failed and where it needs to go, we need to reckon with the actual complex history of these events. And it's not just a story of unending U.S. villainy.
And Matt, just briefly, because we're running out of time for this segment, the Trump administration has also been pushing for increased military expenditures by the NATO countries from 2%. Now he wants 5% of their GDP in terms of military spending. What's your response? Because obviously the United States, as the main producer of weapons in the world, would benefit from such increased military spending by the various countries of Europe.
Right. I mean, this is the point that Trump has made repeatedly, and not just Trump. And I mean, if you remember, Barack Obama was also someone who was pushing NATO member countries to meet their commitments. By raising that commitment, is something very interesting from Trump if he expects that they'll be buying these weapons from the United States. But I think one potentially interesting positive consequence of Trump's approach here is that if it really does force the Europeans to finally, at long last, start taking more serious steps to see to their own security. I mean, some of the comments that were played earlier from Keir Starmer, I'm not so sure about the idea of UK troops patrolling Ukraine. But just the fact that you see European governments now stepping up and looking much with a bit more urgency about their own responsibilities in their own neighborhood, I do think that could have potential, positive consequences for the United States, given the way that, the U.S. Security architecture in Europe is something that helps buttress our own military-industrial complex and diminishes and, I think, really corrupts our own democracy. So anything that weakens the military-industrial complex, I would say, is all to the good.
Matt Dass, we want to thank you for being with us, Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, and economist Jeffrey Sachs, speaking to us from Brussels at the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. We'll link to all of your articles, both Matt and Jeffrey. When we come back, we speak with the Palestinian co-director Bassel Adra about his Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land and about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians from his community in the West Bank, what the film is about. Stay with us.
غصن اللي انكسر بعد ما نسي بعد الحجر قاعد صافي نفس السما بعد ما قسي بعد البحر شارد حامل كل السفن
of Memory by Faraj Suleiman featuring Dima Zahran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the occupied West Bank, where Israel's reportedly planning to build nearly 1,000 new settler homes in the Efrat settlement near Jerusalem. The Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The group Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, condemned the move, saying the Netanyahu government is trying, quote, to establish facts on the ground that'll destroy the chance for peace and compromise, end quote. This comes as Israel's ongoing military operations in the West Bank have displaced at least 45,000 Palestinians, the most since the 67 war. Today, the Oscar-nominated Palestinian director, Bassel Adra, shared video from the occupied West Bank of Israeli forces storming and demolishing four houses in Masafa Ayata. This month, Bassel Adra himself filmed armed and masked Israeli settlers attacking his community of Masafer Yatta. The settlers threw stones, smashed vehicles, slashed tires, punctured a water tank. Israeli soldiers on the scene did not intervene to halt the crimes. Bassel Adra's Oscar-nominated documentary, No Other Land, is about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians living in Masafer Yatta. In another post last week, Bassel wrote, quote, anyone who cared about No Other Land should care about what's actually happening on the ground. Today, our water tanks, 9 homes, 3 ancient caves were destroyed. Masafer Yatta is disappearing in front of my eyes. Only one name for these actions, ethnic cleansing, he said. In a minute, Bassel Adra will join us for an update. But first, we want to play the trailer from his Oscar-nominated documentary, No Other Land.
You think they'll come to our home?
Is the army down there?
1,000 Palestinians face one of the single biggest expulsion decisions since the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories began.
Bassel, come here. Come fast.
This is a story about power. My name is Bassel. I grew up in a small community called Masafer Yatta. I started to film when we started to end. They have bulldozers? I'm filming you.
I need air, oh my God.
Don't worry.
I don't want them to take our home.
You're Bassel?
Yes.
You're Palestinian?
No, I'm Jewish.
He's a journalist. You're Israeli. Seriously.
We have to raise our voices, not being silent as if no human beings live here.
What? The army is here?
This is what's happening in my village now. Soldiers are everywhere.
Who do you think you're filming, you son of a whore?
It would be so nice with stability one day. Then you'll come visit me. Not always me visiting you, right?
Maybe. What do you think? If you were in my place, what would you do?
That's the trailer for the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land, co-directed by the Israeli journalist Yuval Abraham and our next guest, Bassel Adra, Palestinian activist and journalist who writes for 972 magazine. His most recent piece headlined, Our Film is Going to the Oscars, but here in Masafer Yatta, we're still being erased. Bassel has spent years documenting Israeli efforts to evict Palestinians living in his community, Masafer Yatta, south of Hebron. Bassel, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about your film and also what's happening right now. This is not a film about history. It's on the ground now. You recently were barricaded in your house filming what was going on, what the Israeli settlers were doing.
Thank you for having me. Our movie, we worked in it for the last 5 years. We are four people, two Israelis and two Palestinians, me, myself, Yuval and Rachel and Hamdan, who's my friend and living in Masafer Yatta. We're just activists and journalists, and me and my friend Hamdan spent years in the field running after bulldozers, soldiers and settlers and in our communities and communities around us, filming the destruction, the home destructions, the school destructions, the cutting of our water pipes and the bulldozering of our roads and our own schools, and trying to raise awareness from the international community on what's going on, to get political impact, to try to stop this from happening and to protect our community. And 5 years ago, Yuval and Rachel joined as Israeli journalists to write about what's happening, and then we decided together that we will start working on No Other Land as a documentary that show the whole political story through personal individual stories of people who lost their life and homes and school and properties on this, like in the last years and also in the decades of the occupation. We released the movie in the Berlinale 2024 last year at the festival, and so far it has been like doing and screened and showed like in many festivals around the world.
And Basil, your film has received an Oscar nomination, but you haven't been able to find a distributor in the U.S. What do you know about this refusal of any company to pick up your film to distribute? And also, can it be seen in the West Bank or in Israel itself?
I mean, it's sad that we don't find a U.S. distributor. Our goal from making this documentary, it's not the award, it's not the awards itself, but the people and the audience, and to get to the people's hearts, because we want people to see the reality, to see what's going on in my community in Masafer Yatta, but in all the West Bank, to the Palestinians, and how the life. The daily life under this brutal occupation, people should be aware of this, because they are, and somehow they have responsibility. In the U.S., it's the tax money that the people paying there. It's have something to do with the home destruction that we're facing, the settlers' violence, the building of the settlements on our land that does not stop every day. And we as a collective made this movie. We faced so many risks on the field, on the ground. Like my home was invaded and the cameras were confiscated from my home by Israeli soldiers, and I was physically attacked on the field when I'm going around and filming these crimes. I mean, to show to the people and to let the people know about what's going on. But it's sad that the distributors in the U.S. so far do not want to take a little bit of risk, political risk, and to show this documentary to the audience. I'm really sad about it, that there is no big distributor is taking No Other Land and showing to the American people. It's very important to reach to the Americans, I believe. And so far, we are doing it independently on the cinemas.
And your co-director is Israeli. Have you come under criticism for working with Israelis on the film?
So far, I'm not receiving any criticism for working with Israeli. I like working together is that because we share in somehow the same values, that we reject the injustice and the occupation and the apartheid of what's going on, and we want to work pro solution and pro justice, and to end this like settlements and for a better future.
Basil, the Oscars are soon, in a few weeks. Can you get a visa to come into the United States? Will you attend the Oscars?
So I have visa so far, because I've been in the U.S. participating in festivals for our movie. But my family and other Palestinian co-directors does not have yet, and they will try to apply soon, and hopefully they will get it, and they will be able to join us in the Oscar.
So since it's so difficult to see your film here in the United States, I want to go to another clip of No Other Land. Again, this is our guest Basil Adra and his co-director Yuval Abraham. Abraham filming the eviction of a Palestinian family.
A lot of army is here.
They plan a big demolition?
We don't know. They're driving towards one of my neighbors.
Now the soldiers arrive here. He's...
Aren't you ashamed to do this? Aren't you afraid of God?
Go back. Move back now. Get back. I'll push you all the way back.
I speak Hebrew. Don't shout.
I hope that bulldozer falls on your head. Why are you taking our homes? Why destroy the bathroom?
That's Israeli bulldozers destroying a bathroom. This is another clip from No Other Land in which you, Basil, are attacked by Israeli forces even as you try to show them you have media credentials.
I'm filming you. I'm filming you. You're just like criminals.
You get closer, arrest them.
You're expelling us. Arrest me. On what grounds?
Grab them.
On what grounds? I have a journalist's card. I have a journalist's card.
Shut up.
Don't hit my son. Leave our village. Go away. Leave you. Shoot.
Move back.
Shoot me. Shoot me. Shoot me.
Get an ambulance.
Run, Vassil, run. Get up, son, run. Run, Vassil.
Basil, that is you. Your mother is hanging on to you as you're being dragged, your father. What do you want the world to know about Mustafa Yatta, about your community in this film?
I want the world to really act seriously. The international community should take measures and act seriously to end this, like, demolitions and ethnic cleansing that is happening everywhere in Gaza, in the West Bank, through different policies and different, like, reasons that the Israelis try to separate out, which is all lies. It's all about land that they want to steal more and more of our land. That's very clear on the ground, because every Palestinian community being erased, there is a settlement growing in the same place. This is happening right there in the South Hebron Hills, in everywhere around the West Bank in Area C, and now they are entering camps since January until now by demolishing, like destroying the camps in Jenin, Tul Karim, into bus, and forcing people to leave their homes to get away. And the world is just keep watching and not taking serious actions. And the opposite, actually, the Israelis kept receiving all like this amount of violations of the international law, the human rights laws. It's very clear that it's violated every day by the Israelis, but nobody almost cares. The opposite. They kept receiving weapons and money and relationships diplomatic covers.
We have to leave it there. I thank you so much. Look forward to interviewing you and Yuval in the United States. Basil Adra, co-director of the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests. Areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, find us on social media, and please support our vital work through our website.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.